I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, who was Malcolm X really, and how did he become one of the most influential crusaders for Black justice in American history? We'll spend this hour with Tamara Payne, who worked for decades as primary researcher for her father, journalist Les Payne, as he worked on a biography of Malcolm, then brought the book to completion herself after her father died in 2018. We'll talk about what Malcolm's siblings recalled about their brother's early life and temperament, learn why he met secretly with Georgia Klan leaders in 1961, and hear about the reasons he moved away from Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam in his final years. Our conversation starts after a short break. The late Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Les Payne had been fascinated by Malcolm X since he was a teenager, reading and rereading the autobiography crafted in collaboration with writer Alex Haley. But then in the 80s, Payne met and interviewed some of Malcolm's brothers, who told him stories he'd never heard or read before. And he realized there must be a lot of things Malcolm's greatest admirers and detractors didn't know about him. And so Payne set off on a quest that would last the rest of his life to find and tell those new stories and clarify and enrich the ones the world already knew. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Tamara Payne is Les Payne's daughter, and she served as the primary researcher for and co-author of the biography The Dead Are Rising, The Life of Malcolm X. When Les Payne died in 2018, Tamara Payne kept working to finish the project, and the result, which was given the National Book Award for Nonfiction last fall, is a remarkably detailed account of Malcolm's life and death and the events that made him the deeply influential and fully human person that he was. Tamara Payne joins us now to talk about what she and her father learned over the course of all those years of groundbreaking research. Tamara, welcome to Think.
Hello, Chris. Thank you.
So you write in your introduction that your father went to see Malcolm X speak in 1963, and that experience really changed the way your dad saw himself. What influence did Malcolm have on him?
Well, I mean, I'll start with the quotation Martin Luther King used to describe what they kind of like their work, and other people from the civil rights movement use this also, is that segregation imbues the oppressor and the segregator with a false sense of superiority, and the oppressed with a false sense of inferiority. And what that means is that these, in the case of America, we have Jim Crow laws and other segregation-like rules in the North, Jim Crow South, that impact the way Black people were living, where they could move, where they could own land or not own land. And, you know, and the reason being that they're Black. And so Black people, as the oppressed, were internalizing this. And so we all have, you know, Black people have internalized this to some extent. And what that meeting was Dad confronting this sense of inferiority of his own. For example, in the way that Malcolm was speaking in that speech in 1963 in Hartford, he was referring to Black people either as Negroes or as Black people. And in 1963, the term Black was derogatory. And when Malcolm was saying it, you know, people in the hall were very uncomfortable, including Dad. He felt like, Why is he calling us Black? And it just hit him wrong. And so he hears this, and Malcolm addresses it directly. And he says, you know, I see you are uncomfortable with me referring to Black people as Black people, as Black. He says, but you'd rather be called Negro. But what does Negro mean except Black in Spanish? So what you're saying is that I can call you Black in Spanish, but not in English. And so there is a real confrontation. Just Dad wasn't thinking that he sees himself as less than or not as competitive. He's a junior in college at that point, and he's competing, you know, in school, but he's not getting the sense of like that he himself also has this inferiority. And that's where it hit him, that if I can't accept being called Black, which is what I am in my own language, what sense, you know, why not? And so that was what that was about. And we all still are experiencing definite forms of that. We have not finished, you know, confronting this inferiority complex. Whereas the superstructure that Martin Luther King and the other civil rights groups of the 60s were confronting, where they were changing the laws by desegregating the buses, desegregating lunch counters, desegregating jobs, and stores where you could shop, even where you can live, to just confronting that and changing the laws. They're dealing with the superstructure of white supremacy and changing laws, so that when blacks' rights are taken away from them or they're crossed, they have recourse. Black people didn't have recourse before that, but now there's a law that they can sue and they can pursue through the legal system. So
it sounds like decades before your father imagined that he would work on this just extraordinary biography of Malcolm X, he knew the autobiography of Malcolm X backwards and forwards. What do we know about the relationship between Malcolm and his co-author, Alex Haley, and how Haley shaped that narrative that was published, I think, after the assassination, right?
Yeah, it was published after the assassination. Alex Haley, who was a journalist at the time, he was doing a lot of the, he was working at different publications and quite was doing these profiles for Playboy magazine, which are great. He did one with Martin Luther King, he did it with Malcolm X and others, other influential figures. And so his interest, he was always intrigued by Malcolm's life. But Malcolm at that time, because he was a member of the Nation of Islam and basically their national spokesperson, and he wanted to promote the Nation of Islam. So Malcolm's view was to use this book as a PR piece in promoting Elijah Muhammad's teachings in the Nation of Islam. And Alex Haley really wanted to pursue Malcolm's story. And Malcolm really wasn't interested in doing that. So even in the telling of the story, there are different approaches with that. There is this tug and tell, this push and pull that you see in their relationship. If you look through the manuscripts like I did, at the Schomburg Center of Research here in New York, they do have some of the manuscripts of the unpublished chapters and pre-published chapters of the autobiography. And you can see Alex Haley's notes of trying to get Malcolm to be more personal, and then, you know, Malcolm telling these stories, but he has to be coaxed into telling these stories, particularly like of the relationship with his family, his parents, and like, for example, the day that his parents died, you know, that his father died, that, you know, his mother was cooking rabbit stew, for example. That was a great detail that we found in there. And so there was the tug and pull of that. But when Malcolm split from the Nation of Islam, he was more free to do his own story. And so Alex Haley was ready and prepared to push Malcolm on that. But again, you know, Malcolm also had other chapters that were never published that he wanted to be part of the autobiography, and they were never released. And we do have one chapter that we found at the Schomburg, for example, that was never released. And there were some others that over the years have, I believe, had disappeared through different auctions and stuff like that.
So Malcolm's framing of his own life centered, at least early on, around this deeply traumatic event, which was the murder of his father. What were you able to learn about how the Reverend Earl Little died?
That he wasn't murdered. It was in Lansing. He did die in a streetcar accident, and he slimply, you know, went back to get his coat, and he slipped and fell, and the streetcar ran over him, and it was an accident. And but there were whispers, and some people who were whispering that, trying to make this seem like it was a murder, and they took responsibility for it, and there were all these rumors going around about that. But from what we found, talking with people who were in Lansing at the time, and newspaper accounts, and the coroner's report showed that his injuries were due really to, you know, from being run over by the streetcar. And and it's unfortunate that, you know, he died. This is, you know, a huge marking point in Malcolm's youth. But it's important to understand that he did not die at the hands of the KKK. However, that does not mean that the KKK wasn't rampant and that they didn't harm and kill other people. They just did not kill Earl Little in this case. But the other thing I would like to say about that is that reason why Malcolm would want to believe this is possible. We have to keep in mind that. Can I let the siren pass?
Sure.
Can you hear that?
Yeah, everybody's working from home. It happens.
Yeah, okay. What was I going to say? That their family, they were on land and their white neighbors had evicted them from that land. And there was an exclusionary clause in the deed to that land that black people were not to own that land. And this is in Lansing. And so their white neighbors who did not like Malcolm's, the Little family, they pushed them off by evicting them. And then their house was burnt down. And it was not Earl Little that burnt it down. And so there is this belief that, you know, that there's this energy. It's this ominous energy about their presence as being black people in this area of Lansing. So there is reasons why Malcolm would believe that and would cling to that. But from what we found and what we discussed with people who were there at the time, and the story, you know, was that he clearly did he slipped and he fell.
Malcolm's parents had been followers of Marcus Garvey. Can you remind us of who he was and the ideas he espoused that, honestly, a lot of them feel really timely even in the 21st century?
Oh, absolutely. Marcus Garvey was from Jamaica, and he had started his movement in Jamaica and brought it to the States, and basically was about connecting black people all over the world and just feeling pride, being prideful of who they are as black people. And building their own business, building their community, supporting each other, and and just taking pride in being black people, whereas everybody's being beaten down for different reasons. And it was, it was a thriving movement for the black community in America, black communities across the nation. And he would often also travel because he had regional chapters throughout the country and in Canada. And he would often visit homes of different people, including the Littles. And Malcolm did not meet Marcus Garvey, but Wilfred did. And Wilfred did recount meeting him in their home. And it was something they had to keep secret about, but he did come to their home. But Malcolm's father and mother, they met actually at a UNI, Universal Negro Improvement Association, the name of the organization of Marcus Garvey's association. And they had met at one of the meetings in Montreal, and they were attracted to each other, got married, settled in Philadelphia first, had a couple of children, then they moved out west to the Midwest. They started in Omaha, Nebraska. And that, so they already had Wilfred and Hilda, and then Filbert, and then Malcolm was in utero when we open up the book in Omaha, Nebraska, when they're visited by the Klan. So this was a movement that Earl and Louise were members of, and there, what they would do is they would move out to places where there weren't a lot of black families, and they would organize them. So Omaha, Nebraska was a town that was actually growing, and they were organizing them. And then after they were in Omaha, they moved to Milwaukee and also then ended up landing in Lansing, Michigan. But in each of these places, he was organizing chapters and holding meetings and of black people who were not just in the town that they're in, but towns not far away, but locally. And Louise, who also was followed, what she would do is in raising her children, she was raising them on the principles of Garvey, which was was about embracing your blackness, embracing who you are as black people, and showing them that if we can support black businesses, we're gonna do that, and just really building up their the children's belief in who they were as black people, even to this and to the point of when they would receive. When they were taunted in school, and they would complain about it, she would talk to them about, like, you don't have to accept what these people are saying to you.
All right, Tamara, I'm so sorry. I have to jump in for a quick break. My guest is Tamara Payne, co-author and primary researcher of The Dead Are Arising, The Life of Malcolm X. We'll be right back. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Tamara Payne, who is primary researcher and co-author, along with her late father, Les Payne, who died in 2018, of the book The Dead Are Arising, The Life of Malcolm X. It won the National Book Award for Nonfiction in November. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. And before the break, Tamara, you were telling us that Malcolm X's mother, Malcolm Little's mother at the time, used the principles of Garveyism to sort of steel her children against the kind of teasing they might get in school and in the community.
Yeah. She definitely did that. And that was imbuing them with their sense of who they were as Black people and embracing that. And I would say that, you know, Malcolm's sense of who he was as a Black man really was coming from his childhood and his parents.
Here is Malcolm X in 1962 after a confrontation with the LAPD outside a mosque.
Who taught you to hate the texture of your hair? Who taught you to hate the color of your skin to such extent that you bleach to get like the white man? Who taught you to hate the shape of your nose and the shape of your lips? Who taught you to hate yourself from the top of your head to the soles of your feet? Who taught you to hate your own kind? Who taught you to hate the race that you belong to? So much so that you don't want to be around each other. No, before you come asking Mr. Muhammad, does he teach hate? You should ask yourself, who taught you to hate being what God gave you?
Is it fair to say, Tamara, that in a way, Malcolm X, even Malcolm X as associated with the Nation of Islam, remained a Garveyite throughout his life as well?
Yeah, that was a through line throughout his life. That was evidence in Dad's interviews with Wilfred. He said that they talked about Garveyism and the philosophies through till the end with Malcolm. And I just want to say about the relationships, even with the brothers. My father, Les Payne, he interviewed both brothers. Those were the initial two first interviews that launched him on this journey. He interviewed both Philbert first, who was only a couple years older than Malcolm. But when he went back to interview the eldest brother at the urging of his colleague, Gil Noble, Wilfred turned out to be not only just Malcolm's oldest brother, who's older than Malcolm by 6 years, but his best friend. So it was really interesting to hear from Wilfred's his perspective of Malcolm through all the phases that we come to study and learn about Malcolm. And Wilfred's take on them. And that was one of the things that he said was that, Garveyism, the family knew. All of the siblings, you know, understood and lived by those principles and especially Malcolm. That came from their childhood.
Malcolm, of course, would get into some trouble as a teenager and a young adult. Did the brothers feel like there was always something special about him, though, that the family could always identify that he was going places?
They knew that he was different. They thought that he was smart, but all of the siblings are smart and grounded. But Malcolm definitely kind of stood out with his personality too. He wasn't shy and and he was a little on the precocious side too. But when he's drifting after his father dies, who was kind of that anchor for him, that's the guide for him in a lot of ways. And for a lot of, all the siblings, but particularly for Malcolm, it really hurts him in the sense of, you know, he's missing that figure, that energy, you know, to test up against, to talk with, you know, to learn from directly. And so, he does drift. He gets into trouble. He's a teenager and, you know, even when he goes into prison, you know, I'll fast forward a little bit, is that he's 20 years old. So a lot of this, when we talk about his crime life, and one of the things I always say about Malcolm has always been presented to us fully formed and angry as, you know, and the purpose of this book and why Dad really wanted, you know, when he's learning about Malcolm's family life, is to put him in context, but not just in context of his family and his lineage, but in context of the world that he was born into. And so you have to understand that he's going through the Great Depression. The Great Depression didn't just affect the Little family and Black community, it affected everybody. When World War II is announced, it affects everybody. So Dad wanted to put Malcolm in this context of these events that impacted his life as he lived, as he navigated when he was on this planet.
The man referred to in the autobiography of Malcolm X as Bimby was actually a guy that you've identified as John E. Bembry, who had educated himself while he was incarcerated. He was older. What kind of influence did he have on this young inmate, Malcolm Little?
He was the one that kind of, you know, and when we talk about this kind of father figure, he really gravitated to Malcolm, was able to, you know, let him know that there are other ways. You don't have to be so physical and confrontational. You can be, you know, physically confrontational, but you can also be mentally confrontational and be even more effective. And he's the one that really encourages Malcolm to read different philosophies and read all these different books. And Malcolm, you know, it was like the thing that just ignites him to opening up his mind and learning, reading everything that he could get his hands on. And even to the point of, you know, debating in prison. He was on the debate team and even debated, you know, Ivy League debate team. So, you know, this really pushed Malcolm to get back to, you know, even what his family wanted for him too. It was like, they didn't want him to drop out of school, but he did. And it wasn't unusual for him. I mean, if you have other opportunities and you had more important, really your situation required you to make money, I mean, it's not unusual for that to happen. So, yeah, he really influenced Malcolm to read, and Malcolm Jarvis, who went into prison with Malcolm. This was Malcolm's running mate from Boston.
It was Malcolm's siblings who started writing to him about Islam while he was incarcerated. Why was he initially reluctant to take up with the Nation of Islam, and what changed his mind?
Malcolm was also, he was trying to pivot. He was trying to figure out what his next move was going to be. He obviously didn't want to be continue hustling, or he needed to figure something else out. His family, you know, Wilfred had joined the Nation of Islam and gotten all of his siblings, and his plan was also bring Malcolm in to the Nation of Islam, and he got his brother, one of the brothers, to go out to the prison and talk to Malcolm about that. And Malcolm had issues with, you know, when he was learning about the Nation, and he was all on that, except when they talked about the blue-eyed white man being the blue-eyed devil. And Malcolm's run-ins with white people at that time, now, he had anger towards white people, but he also said that there were white people, for example, when he was hustling in Harlem, you know, who had given him responsibilities, and his brother had to show him that, as a numbers runner, for example, he was left basically physically and literally holding the bag. And if he had gotten caught, you know, the money that they paid him to hold that bag of money, you know, was nothing, you know, if they lost it, they paid you and then that was it. But the thing is, if they really wanted him to be a partner of this operation, they would have given him a cut of all the money that they were making. So that's how he got to, you know, understand. And then Malcolm had to see that plan for what it was. And then he was able to fully, you know, turn into what the Nation of Islam was bringing to him and bring him out of.
I mean, knowing with the benefit of hindsight how extraordinarily charismatic he was, it's not surprising that he rose quickly through the organization, but it wasn't a foregone conclusion. How did he attract the attention of Elijah Muhammad?
His charisma, I also want to say, you know, he also got that from his father by going to the UNIA meetings. His father would take him to the UNIA meetings in Lansing, and he got to see his father interact and lead these meetings. And so he kind of knew how to talk with people. And, but Malcolm's, you know, encouragement, he, he was a talker. He impressed Elijah Muhammad. And what happened was Wilfred basically asked Elijah Muhammad to talk with Malcolm. And he said, yes, he's in jail, but, you know, he's going to come and he'll be a great asset to the organization, which he was. And so Elijah Muhammad, you know, because already Wilfred had proven that the Little family was a great asset to the organization. Wilfred himself and Filbert were rising up through the ranks. And so Elijah Muhammad was willing to listen to him. And he listened to Malcolm. He was impressed. He was impressed by his charisma, but his wanting to change. And Malcolm embraced it. I mean, he saw the cleaner eating, the giving up of pork and no alcohol and no drugs and all the gambling and all of that. He had no problem letting go of that. He was very disciplined. But keep in mind, he's also coming out of prison. He wants to be free.
He ran a tight ship in the communities that he was given to lead, it sounds like. People remember that about him.
Yeah. And it didn't go over so well in some of them. And that's kind of when he first came out and joined the Nation in Detroit. It was really interesting listening to the couple that he lived with, Mustafa Hussein and his wife. He lived with them. He was living with Wilfred at first, and then he ended up staying with them. They gave him a room, basically, and he was organizing, and Mustafa was impressed with Malcolm and organized with Malcolm meaning they were recruiting new members, and Malcolm was going after college-educated young people, and the people that were already members of the Nation were not as educated. They were laborers and workers and blue-collar workers, and so there was this kind of clash, and people felt kind of threatened by that, and they would start rumors and create this really uncomfortable atmosphere for Malcolm, and he had to be, you know, he ended up being sat out by Elijah Muhammad, and he said, you have to calm down, you have to slow down, and he's basically said, I'm going to send you to the East. You pick any of the temples, and he started with Boston. And again, that, you know, seemed to flourish. He seemed to flourish there because it was a different mindset and different people that he was surrounded by.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Is there any evidence, Tamara, that Elijah Muhammad had a problem with the sort of rising star of Malcolm X, in some ways almost eclipsing his own profile?
Mainly, I think that was happening really because other people were talking about it. And people, you know, they wanted to go to their, because Elijah Muhammad's the leader. But the other thing is that Malcolm, he may have been eclipsing the leader in the media because people could talk to him and relate to Malcolm. There was a different relationship that some people had towards Elijah Muhammad. He didn't appeal necessarily to the kind of people that Malcolm was recruiting. And but he was bringing them in. So Elijah Muhammad, you know, he liked having the organization grow. He appreciated what Malcolm was bringing in and spreading the word. But the issue, I think, really became when people were just raising, kept bringing it up and creating this uncomfortable atmosphere that Malcolm was, you know, he was getting out of control and starting that kind of rumor and atmosphere against Malcolm, this whispering campaign. And I think that's really what was going on with Elijah Muhammad, because I think Elijah Muhammad really embraced Malcolm. He knew who Malcolm was. He was a good study of character. And he could have been, if he was really threatened by his eclipsing him, he would have kicked him out in Detroit. He sent him east to grow the organization even more.
All right, I want to talk about this story that you tell in extraordinary detail. There is this meeting between Elijah Muhammad sends Malcolm X and some other emissaries to meet face-to-face with Klan leaders in Georgia. How did that come about?
It was great journalism, I would say, on Dad's part, in that, you know, one of the things that I learned from Dad is saying that, you know, journalism is really happening when people tell you something that they should not, and also when somebody tells you no. That's when you really start to do your work. And And so, but Jeremiah Shabazz, who he was known as Jeremiah Shabazz when we interviewed him, but at the time as though as Jeremiah X, he was the minister. He never talked about that meeting. And Dad, in talking with him, got him to talk about that and tell him the details. And, you know, and Jeremiah, he wasn't tricked. He understood what he was doing, but he had not told this to anybody else. And that's kind of really, they had this relationship of talking about, you know, this other side of like the Southern aspect of the Nation of Islam, that their campaign of growing the organization, trying to get land and have farms. And they were, you know, they were able to do some things down there. And Jeremiah Shabazz was very much a part of that and instrumental in that. So this Klan meeting comes about where Jeremiah X is the minister of Atlanta Mosque in Georgia, and Malcolm is visiting. And he's giving a sermon there. And while Malcolm is speaking, this telegram comes in that's delivered from, the Klan. And it's basically saying, we would like to meet with you. And as I said earlier, that Malcolm is not the leader in Jeremiah. They're not the leader of the Nation of Islam. So the protocol is to go back to Elijah Muhammad and discuss this with them. And they make no moves without, you know, Elijah Muhammad's approval. So they go and discuss this. And, you know, Malcolm, he's excited because he looks at this as an opportunity for the nation and the KKK to have, you know, a face-off. And he's listening to Elijah Muhammad, who says, well, let's see what we can get out of this. You know, they want to meet with us. Let's find out what they want to do. But, you know, we're interested in setting up a separate state. We are interested in acquiring land. We want to set up businesses down there, and maybe, you know, the Klan can help us do that. And if not help us do this, they can help us by not, you know, bothering us or interfering with us. And so he sends them to find out what they want to talk about, but also that's kind of what he wants to find out, if they can work something out in the, you know, along those lines.
All right, I'm going to have you pause there. Excuse me for interrupting, Tamara. I'm going to have you pause because we have to take a break, and I want to make sure you have plenty of time to finish this story. My guest is journalist Tamara Payne, primary researcher and co-author, along with her father, the late Les Payne, of The Dead Are Rising, The Life of Malcolm X. It won the National Book Award for Nonfiction in November. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Tamara Payne, primary researcher and co-author of the book The Dead Are Arising, The Life of Malcolm X. It won the National Book Award for Nonfiction in November. You were telling us before the break, Tamara, so there's this meeting proposed by the Klan. Elijah Muhammad tells Jeremiah X and Malcolm X, see, you know, what could happen. I guess, ironically, the two groups found a sort of common cause in their desire for fully separate spaces for Black and white people. Did the Nation of Islam, though, differentiate between separatism and segregation?
Yeah, they did. I mean, basically, they didn't want to be with white people at all. White people are like, the Klan was saying that you can, we don't mind you, you know, serving us, and we don't mind you cleaning our houses. We don't mind you working for us, mm-hmm. but, you know, but you don't live with us, don't live among us. So that was their view of segregation. And, you know, and the nation was, we want nothing to do with you because you guys are evil. And that, you know, that was the difference. And, you know, Martin Luther King and his groups, they were, and not his groups, but, Martin Luther and the civil rights groups, what they were doing was they wanted to change the superstructure of this and challenge. And that's why, you know, the Klan felt this threat of their superstructure being torn down. And they saw that, you know, Martin Luther King was making headway with this, and they didn't like that. So they were thought they could make an alliance, you know, with Nation of Islam and see King as their common enemy. But you have to read the book to see how that plays out.
All right. You're going to leave us. It is a good story. All right. I'll move on from that if you don't want to tell the story. We will say that the meeting left Malcolm with a bad taste in his mouth.
Yeah, I will. it was important to make sure it's understood that Malcolm's already, you know, as I said, Malcolm wanted, really doesn't, he doesn't want to have an alliance, but he also didn't want the nation going in there, you know, begging, you know, for favors either from the Klan. And he, in listening to Elijah Muhammad's directions, he realized that, you know, this didn't set right with him. And that was the beginning of this rift between him and Elijah Muhammad. And it just, you know, it tears even further as time passes after this. And there are different times, different events that happen where Malcolm just sees that his view of what, you know, their work should be and Elijah Muhammad's view are very different. And so that starts it. And, you know, and Malcolm's basically outgrowing this organization.
Had Malcolm always been aware of the ways that Elijah Muhammad sometimes preached one set of values and practiced another? Had he just kind of made allowances for that in the past, or did he start to really understand it in a new way after a while?
He was understanding it in a new way after a while. I mean, there were times he would say that, and even his brother Wilfred would say this about Malcolm, is that, you know, Malcolm really believed in what he was preaching about the Nation of Islam and what they were doing as far as dealing with how Black people saw themselves. You played in that clip about how you see yourselves, who told you you're so ugly, and that he really believed in what that work that he was doing and wanting to stand up for themselves and not, you know, he didn't believe in the turn the other cheek that Martin Luther King was preaching at that time. And so he totally believed in that work, and Elijah Muhammad was approving of what Malcolm's work was at the time. So Malcolm really saw them in sync and in line, but then he starts seeing these other things, like with the Klan meeting and their confrontation with the police that happens in New York and in other places. It happens in Louisiana, it happens in California. And, you know, he really sees, you know, that this is, you know, he's not preaching, you know, that Elijah Muhammad doesn't necessarily even believe necessarily what he's making everybody else follow. And that's what really just, you know, kind of disturbs him. And he has to figure out a way to accept that and embrace that, or as he ends up having to do is leave.
Here he is speaking in Detroit in 1964.
We must understand the politics of our community. And we must know what politics is supposed to produce. We must know what part politics play in our lives. And until we become politically mature, we will always be misled, led astray, or deceived, or maneuvered into supporting someone politically who doesn't have the good of our community at heart. So the political philosophy of Black nationalism only means that we will have to carry on a program, a political program of re-education, to open our people's eyes, make us become more politically conscious, politically mature. And then we will, whenever we get ready to cast our ballot, that ballot will be cast for a man of the community who has the good of the community at heart. And
it's interesting to hear that sound on a day when the entire country is watching elections in the state of Georgia, Tamara.
Absolutely. And, you know, and what you hear him in saying is that his work and what he was trying to do is to encourage people to build, have the character to run and be part of this government and represent our communities, not just vote for any politician that was running. But he's trying to get us to be of that character, to stand up for our rights and what our needs are in addressing them, not just accepting from any politician. And yeah, and listening to that, I was just feeling like, gosh, this is so important that people hear this need to be politically mature, not just Black people, but everybody at this point.
Do you think Americans are making progress toward being politically mature?
I think we kind of regressed in the last few years. I'm sorry. It's not funny. It's very sad, actually. I think that there's been a process of people regressing on the political scale, definitely. And the election of Trump has shown that.
Was it emotionally difficult, that break from the Nation of Islam? Because, I mean, there's, you know, you mentioned him outgrowing the organization. There were conflicts. On the other hand, this had also been really a formative organization for him.
It was absolutely painful. You know, he never really recovered from that. I mean, yes, he went on and he was doing other things, but he missed that. You know, if you're going to do the kind of work that he was set to do and he was putting in place to do, you can't do it by yourself. And he really loved what the work and the influence that he had in the organization. And he was hoping to keep growing it in that direction. But he also realized that, you know, he also had to leave it because where he wanted to go and that there were too many forces in the organization who were set against him. Partly out of the direction that Elijah Muhammad was going, so that he had a rift with. But you also had people who were just, you know, did not want to go in the direction that Malcolm was going. They wanted to, you know, they wanted to keep it the way Elijah Muhammad was going and keep, you know, looking the other way when infractions or the inconsistencies were happening. So, yeah, I mean, they saw Malcolm as a threat to that. And so... But for Malcolm himself, yeah, it was absolutely emotional. It was painful for him.
There's this tiny, poignant moment in the book where he's going to speak somewhere and he has broken from the Nation of Islam. And he many people want to hear him speak, but he doesn't command the kind of power in a room that he once did when he had this organization behind him. And it seems to me that's such a human moment for a human person, given the fact that Malcolm has become this figure that people have made all kinds of things of in the years since his assassination, we don't think of him often enough as just a human person.
Well, that's the whole point of the book, is to look at this human being. And, you know, he's presented to us fully formed and angry and, you know, not coming from anything. We're not having no family. Yes, he got married and he had children, but we don't do a lot of talking about who his parents were and how did they influence him? How did his, you know, mother influence him? How did his father? His father was not just a great organizer of people, but even in their farms, he organized the neighbors to share their crops and market them. And so this is where he's coming from. We don't talk about this. And this is all human. Aspects of Malcolm to understand. But even more importantly for me is that this story, it coincides with our own stories. And I don't care what race we are, but, you know, if you grew up in the Midwest, you can relate to these stories. You can relate to the stories of the farming. You can relate to the stories of going to school. You can relate to these stories. You can relate if you grew up in New York and coming up against, you know, dealing with the police oppression and stuff like that. I mean, you can relate to that, but when you talk about his family and where they were in the Great Migration, for example, and what happened to them during the Depression, these stories are also parallel to our own stories, where our families were during that period. And you can do comparisons and you can learn more about yourself when you realize that, wow, this can really impact these people who lived through that, and then that pain carried down into the generations that were not there, but became later, like us.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Why was Malcolm X killed?
He was a threat. He was a threat to people saw him as you know, I've already talked a bunch about the Nation of Islam, but he was a threat also to the government. Hoover, who was the head of the FBI, had infiltrated the Nation of Islam and wanted to weaken it. And so even more dissension in the organization. And you had other forces. You had in New York, you also had when Malcolm was weakened because he was no longer part of the Nation of Islam, and now he has to start organizing new groups. And even those groups become infiltrated by the police as well as the FBI. So he's surrounded. He's seen as a threat, and he's surrounded. And all of these forces... Basically, they play their roles, and he is assassinated. Yes, you can point your fingers at it and say the hit came from the Nation, but if it only involved the Nation, why are we having the police infiltrating his group and they're on the scene working as a security in the form of Gene Roberts? Why do we have FBI informants calling their bosses, reporting that he's been killed? There's much bigger, you know, story here, I think, and that he's a threat to a lot of things, and they all played their roles to have him taken out.
He was aware of these risks and all the people who wanted him dead. Did he live like he was living on borrowed time?
He didn't stop, you know, his work. His work was really important. And think about, too, his family, like his wife and his daughters, who, you know, he's the last year of his life, he's traveling throughout Africa. And I think this is really important to understand. He even changes the civil rights movement when he leaves the Nation of Islam, and he's meeting, you know, in these secret meetings, and he comes up the idea of taking their fight from the civil rights platform to an international platform and calling it human rights violations, and taking the United States to the UN to bring charges against the United States for violating Black people's human rights. So he's traveling around Africa to gain support as well as learn and take his Hajj and fully, you know, further his studies in Sunni Islam. And, you know, all this is time away from his family. His wife doesn't see him, his children, she's pregnant during this time, and his daughters don't see him. I mean, this is, you know, he never stopped working.
So this book won the National Book Award for Nonfiction a few weeks ago, which is like this huge, extraordinary thing. I have to imagine it was bittersweet to accept it without your father at your side to enjoy the moment. Do you have the sense that you know exactly how he might have reacted, what he might have said?
He would have been really happy. He would have been really proud of this. And he would really, you know, push people to, you know, further delve into Malcolm. He doesn't feel that this was a definitive biography of Malcolm by any means. I mean, he wanted to tell the most accurate story he could tell. And by bringing me on, I am so happy that was part of that process. And he would be really proud of that moment, but he also would encourage people, especially young people, to pursue looking into telling these stories and don't stop and giving up on these stories, no matter how long it takes.
I'm sure you learned things from and about your dad working with him for all these years. Do you think he learned about you through this process?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he learned that I can be just as tenacious as he is in not letting things go. And, but he really encouraged me to try all things, whether it was editing and writing, but also in preparing for interviews, which was probably the thing that I just was so fascinated by, how Dad worked to interview people. And you don't just interview one person one time and that's it. I mean, we interviewed people numerous times. And so we go back and we have to recheck what they told us and talk to other people that they mentioned in the interview and then say, well,
Tamara,
this person said
I'm
this.
So sorry, I have to jump in. Tamara Payne was primary researcher for and co-author of the biography The Dead Are Arising, The Life of Malcolm X, working with her father, the late journalist Les Payne. Tamara, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for making time for us.
Thank you, Chris.
I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.